How are you, man?
I'm so good. Completely tired. We've been moving house over the last 2 weeks or so. So, yeah, I'm bushed, but bushed. Really, really good.
So, what do you mean moving? You just bought a new place or what do you got going on?
No, we're still renting. The housing market for people my age is ridiculous. So, renting at the moment, but somewhere bigger, nicer. I now have my own garage, which is good. Whereas
it's
beforehand,
a massive, massive garage, right? You've got tons of space.
Oh, yeah. All 18 feet is it's anything anyone could ever want.
I don't understand how guys that love cars exist with the garages that you guys have. I built a Volkswagen Rabbit once in a one stall garage, and I had to put an easy up, which is like a little tent, on the outside of the garage so that I could work in the rain and not have the snow on me and stuff. It was absolutely small, and it was horrible. And I'm like, I can't wait to get out of here. But realistically, that's every single garage that you guys have.
Yeah, it's something that I think a long time ago, people didn't have the foresight to build bigger when they had the chance. And now that that precedent or that tradition has been set, everything we build is just tiny, and I can't understand why.
That's probably because all you had to do was keep a horse in there. It's not like everybody had, I don't know, a lorry back in the day, right? Yeah, your civilization's a little bit older than ours over here.
A little bit, yeah.
So I'm thinking about, you know, how to start this conversation. I wanted to kind of go back a little bit. And this is something I didn't really know about you till, and we've talked a lot over the years. I went back and scrolled through our old conversations. We've talked about a ton of different stuff. But one thing I didn't know is that you grew up on a farm. And when I think farm, I think American farm, which is like where my family grew up, which is just this enormous sprawling property, right? You've got huge barns, huge silos for grain, and everything is just absolutely massive. And then I think of farms that you guys have, and I immediately think of Jeremy Clarkson's show, which is like dudes like running after sheep, right? So like what kind of farm are we talking about here?
To understand the farm, I think you need to understand my family and the very, very niche makeup that we've got. So I'll go a little further back. I was born to a Zimbabwean mum and a French dad, and when I was about 4 years old, moved us out to South Africa. And so said farm that you're mentioning was a farm out there. Okay. And it was an apple farm. It was apples and pears and occasionally like other fruit. So it wasn't fields. It was rows and rows and rows of trees, just countless trees. I mean, millions of trees. And that was fruit farming. And, I spent the majority of my childhood on a fruit farm, but on that farm was, my grandfather ran the farm, and on it was his two huge workshops where he kept his tractors, his pickup trucks, his tools, everything you can, any toy you could ever imagine was in these two enormous sheds. And that's where I think the earliest memories of working on stuff and tinkering and learning sort of came from and evolved from, was that farming environment. So
was he always kind of in there fixing all the equipment? I mean, do you guys do a lot of, some farms, you know, like modern farms these days, nobody really works on anything, and maybe they're not even allowed to if it's a John Deere. But like the old stuff, are you maintaining all this stuff as it breaks, the equipment, and that's why all the tools are there? Is someone constantly in there tinkering and wrenching?
Well, they had to. It was in the middle of nowhere. Your nearest dealer, if you want to call it that, like John Deere or Massey, was a good 100 miles away at minimum. And a lot of the stuff was my granddad was fixing himself. And he had to, well, him and his team of workers, his foreman, whatever, they had to fix a lot of the stuff themselves. And when we were younger, we would often just be next to him, just learning. Oh, okay, this is a spark plug. This is a spanner. This is a ratchet. And that's where a lot of it evolved from. But yeah, it was definitely a very self-sufficient environment. And probably the best place for someone like me to grow up, thinking about it now.
CSF Cooling has always been at the forefront of quality products for a fair price. With a rich history stretching over 7 decades, they provide the best high-performance and OEM Plus cooling systems on the market today. CSF offers over 3,000 different cooling applications for the most popular makes and models on the road today. From classic copper brass radiators for Land Cruisers, Jeeps, and Datsuns, to vintage 80s Mercedes, BMW, and Audi and Porsche platforms, all the way up to new vehicles. Check out their expanding Classic Series lineup and be sure to check them out at csfrace.com or on social media.
Do you have a moment that you can look back of like one of the first things that you fixed? Like a proud moment of anything that happened back then?
Probably a bicycle. If I think like really hard, there was a bicycle that I used all the time. And that was just a little black bike. I can't even remember the name or brand or anything. But then my granddad and I would fix fishing poles and things like that. And it started small. It started with those little things that evolved into other things. And eventually I would work on the tractors and everything else with it.
So you say, were you raised by your granddad?
In that sense, yeah. Definitely. Okay. Alongside my mom, my granddad had an enormous influence on my childhood. And I'm very fortunate that he is still with us to this day and still working. We're trying to get him to retire and he just refuses. He's 82 years old and he will not retire.
Don't make him retire.
No.
Don't do it. You know, I look at my grandfather and I think he's 93. And I was raised by my grandpa, and I can, and he's getting old. He's really slowing down. I don't know how much time he's got left, but I can see if you could draw a chart between time he spent in the garage tinkering on stuff, because he was a farmer. He grew up, he would never pay anyone to fix anything. He'd rather screw it up 3 times before finally end up. I mean, the dude just fixed everything himself. I don't think we ever saw anyone over at the house fixing anything. It was always something. He built roofs, built contraptions, all this stuff. But there's like a chart you could draw with the time he spent in the garage tinkering on things and his mental health and his physical health. You could see it. Like you could draw that line between, oh, he needs to maybe like not go out there so much. And what if he falls down out there? What all this stuff. And you could just draw this line between when you make people or ask people to just slow down a little bit. I don't know. I feel like it's like the worst thing for him.
Definitely. And actually, I'm no scientist or doctor, but I've seen research that suggests that people suffer more from stress-induced heart attacks when they can no longer do the things they love doing. And they're forced to slow down. And it's incredible, really, that there is such a strong correlation with feeling able and feeling better about yourself and being able to do all of those things. So I don't think we want him to slow down. Thinking about my granddad now, but then, you also want what's best for him. And if his health starts to decline, then that's a totally separate argument. You know, do you stop someone doing what they love? Or do you just let him carry on?
Yeah. I think about that all the time as I get older. You know, I wonder at what point where I look at my life where instead of gaining, I will start losing. Yeah. You know, you spend a lot of your life accruing through time and effort and talent and everything else. You get money, you buy things, you start to experience things, you explore, you do things, and you continue to like collect, right? You collect all these memories, you collect all these things, you have kids, you get a wife, you get a family, you have family. And then I'm not necessarily talking about loss through loss of family members. It's just like, maybe you're just not gaining anymore. You know, where does that point stop? Like, is it stop at retirement? Like, does your granddad at 82, 83 years old, where does that point stop where you're just not gaining anything anymore? And I'm really scared of reaching that point. It's the most terrifying thing that I can think of right now is when I stop gaining knowledge and experiences.
Yeah, I don't think we ever stop gaining knowledge. I mean, even I'm still young, but I've got, you know, hopefully 60 years ahead of me. But I think I learn something new every day. And I'm constantly looking for the next thing to learn and improving upon myself. And I hope that point of gaining versus losing, I hope that the gaining carries on for a very long time for me. And I know that it will if you're keen and if you want to and if you're seeking, then it'll be there.
Yeah, that's why I think that's one of the reasons why I'm so into exploring. You know, it's like it's exposing yourself to new experiences. So you talk about working on a bike, but was there any cars in this barn? Like, are you working on any cars back then? Where did that start for you?
Only his Land Rovers, which I know are not as common in America as they are in parts of Africa and in the UK and Europe.
Here it's but all those, luxury, man. Any Land Rover, Range Rover, any of that stuff is all just like rich douchebags here. It's not like
you guys just don't get them. Like, as in not that you don't understand them, as in you never got them. Like, they didn't export them. And I never understood that, because your climate, your environment, your agricultural industry suits them perfectly.
Yeah, but come on, we have the F-150. How is that thing going to replace an F-150 in terms of just, I'm not saying that either one is better than the other. Obviously, they both have their benefits, and I think the F-150 is probably a lot cheaper, and a pickup truck is very American. But if you brought that the little SUV here and you showed it to a farmer in 1977 or 1988, whatever it is, mid-80s, low-80s, and you're like, hey, you should drive this instead of your F-150. There's no way, dude. There's no way.
You guys are very loyal to brands. That would have been a very hard transition for a lot of people to make, especially farmers.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no way. I think that's probably why. I mean, that's a really hard, in terms of using it as utility.
Yeah.
That's a hard market to penetrate for sure.
Yeah. I think going back to those, when I think back to the cars that we would have been working on, then my granddad owned every single type, mark, year of Land Rover you can ever think of. He still loves them to this day, and he still has about three of them. But those were the sort of earliest memories of working on a car, was that agricultural lump.
What was your first car?
Mine was a Mini from 1972.
No kidding. Why? That's like... I mean, that's a choice right there. Of all the things you could own, that's a choice.
Yeah, I still have it as well.
Well, so it fits great in that tiny garage, I'm sure.
It's not here, unfortunately. It's at my parents' house, but I still have that car. I got it when I was 15, and I'm 26 now, so what's that, 11 years ago? I've still got it, and still working on it.
That sounds like you should drive it up.
Yeah, I need to get it moved. I need to get it sorted and finished. And no, that was my first, and that taught me a lot in the way of self-learning and making mistakes. I made a lot of mistakes on that car. I taught myself how to weld on that car for the first time. I learned about how to not remove an engine and gearbox. At least not safely. That was a big learning curve, because it's, for something so small and so simple, there is a hell of a lot that you can do wrong if you're not careful.
Yeah, once it's the second time going through something is always way easier, because you don't have to figure it out, you don't have to learn.
Yeah.
So Mini's first car, how did you end up in a career where it was your job? I mean, I know you went into the Air Force, and I want to talk about that too. But when you're working on the Mini and you're going to college and stuff like that, are you thinking you want to eventually work on cars forever, or is it something that just ended up happening later?
Petrolbox is a monthly service made specifically for the automotive enthusiast. Each month, they carefully select items including tools, detailing supplies, apparel, garage gear, stickers, and publications to be sent right there to your doorstep. It's a curated selection of the latest and greatest gear in the industry, and there's actually two different levels of subscription to choose from. The Petrobox Basic costs less than $20 a month, while the Petrobox Premium gets you even more gear for $39.95 a month. Check them out at mypetrolbox.com, and be sure to use the code Overcrest at checkout to get $6 off your first month.
I always wanted to be where I am today, I think. I always wanted to be in Formula One. The stint with the Air Force was very brief, largely inspired by your own conversations with the likes of Chinko Hamilton, bless him. That sort of era was a very strange time of my life. The car thing goes back way further than anything else, and the passion for cars and motorsport is something that's been ingrained since day one. And when I left, I used to hate high school because they had those career days and they forced you to go to them. And they were like, you have to go to this compulsory career day and speak to people from business consultancies and accountants. And I'm thinking, kill me. Because in high school, I knew what I wanted to do. I said, I'm going to go and work on race cars. And my teachers all thought that was ridiculous. And then I went to college, university.
Did anyone believe in you at the time?
I think my mom and dad, they knew what I loved to do and they supported me every step of the way. They were like, yeah, you know, the little pat on the head saying, you go for it, sweetie. I knew where I wanted to be and where I wanted to end up. And as soon as school finished, I packed my bags and went off to college or university, college. And I studied engineering and specifically engineering with a focus on motorsport, which is something that universities in the UK offer. And
is that unique to the UK?
Sorry?
Is that unique to the UK? Like, I've never heard of that.
I don't know, because I know people at universities in America who have majored in more automotive sciences and automotive engineering. But in the UK especially, we offer specific motorsport engineering related courses. So that was my major, to translate for your American audience. That was my major. It was my focus was motorsport engineering. And I knew that I wanted to end up in Formula One. I knew that I wanted to be in that environment, in the R&D world of F1, which was the focus from the very start. So went off to uni, studied, and then when I was about 20 years old, during what would have been my my third year at university, I did my internship with the team that I'm at now. Although they've gone through so many name changes, they were at that point known as Scuderia Toro Rosso. I did my internship with them, which was 12 months, full time, normal. You know, as the intern in any of the teams here, you're treated like a full time employee. So it was 12 months on the job, in the what was then a different department, because it's moved and things have changed. And when the internship was finished, I had to go back to college for one more year, finish my degree and get my little certificate and my cap and gown. And unfortunately, I was of the year that we graduated during that big old pandemic. So that knocked us all sideways. The industry in the UK and I'd say in Europe in general was at that time then oversaturated with a market of fresh graduates, fresh engineers, and nowhere for them to work.
Right.
So that's when things took a slightly sideways sort of shift. And I turned my career, or I turned my attention toward things that I'd always wanted to pursue outside of my sort of main field. And the conversation and the idea behind applying to the Air Force came up again, because it was something I'd thought about many years ago before I could get into university, because after high school I was struggling to get into any universities. And at that time we'd graduated, we were sort of on the job market, and I said, you know who is always hiring? The defense sector. They are always hiring people. They'll take me on.
For thousands of years, they have had job postings.
Exactly. It's like, who do you turn to? And actually, there's a funny thing behind that as well, because if you tune into TV or radio in the UK around the time that kids' exam results and school results come out, the Ministry of Defence absolutely pumps their marketing. It's a known trend that there is a spike in the amount of adverts for the Army, Marines, Air Force, and everything around the time that school kids get their results. So it's always in the back of people's minds, and everyone knows someone here who is either active duty or reserves or ex-mil or something. So this conversation came up again, and I thought, do you know what? I've got nothing to lose. I have my degree now. I'm finished university. I've done my internship, so I have some experience. Let me give it a shot. And I applied and got through the first few interview stages.
What did you apply for specifically? Was there a specific thing?
I applied to be a pilot, which a lot of people found quite hilarious, because the old wives' tale is you have to be really, really small to be a pilot. And I'm not that. I'm about 6'5", 250 pounds. Like, I'm not a small guy. So yeah, it was like, okay, that this is going to be weird. But I applied, passed all the what they call first stage interviews, passed the fitness tests, everything else, got through the sort of aptitude testing. That was all good. And then I flunked out. Well, I didn't flunk out. I got flunked out on the medical, because they were not happy with my cardiovascular health. When I was younger, I had undergone a number of heart operations. So I've had, I'm 26 years old and I've had multiple open heart surgeries, which is something that they did not like. So they said, oh, you're a health risk. We can't afford to deal with that or bother with that. And they've got so many people applying. To them, it costs nothing to just say no to one candidate. Yeah. So that door was slammed shut at that stage.
What did that feel like?
That was a massively depressing moment, because at that point, then I'd been rejected from jobs. I'd been rejected from the military, the Ministry of Defense. You're sitting with you and your mates, your friends, all job hunting, and you feel like you have nowhere to go. And that was around the time that a lot of us were getting jobs in like anywhere we could. Like I worked at a supermarket for some time, which surprises a lot of people. A good friend of mine now who designs gearbox casings was working in a hardware store. We got whatever work we could. And it was an emotionally draining time, because you'd be sat at home sending off job application after job application all day long and hearing nothing back, or just hearing straight up rejection. And that was tricky. And I know I sound like, oh, there's bigger problems in the world, but at that time, I promise you, that was a horrible thing for us to be going through. It was emotionally draining and tiring, and something I wouldn't wish on anyone who's fresh faced and keen out of college to try and make their mark on the world. But it was a very educational time as well. It provoked a lot of self-reflection and a lot of thinking about my future. It provoked a lot of conversations and thoughts that I hadn't really considered before. And I just thought, okay, I'm going to wait this time out. I'm going to go through the motions. I'm going to do whatever work I can. I'm just going to ride the wave. I'll ride through this storm. And that was very much an attitude that myself and a lot of my friends had to carry. And I think it made us more resilient for it.
No, there's no doubt about that. I mean, that's tempering of character.
Yeah, it definitely was. It was, if you want to look at it that way, absolutely. It was work hardening us for the real world. And it was an incredible introduction into what the real world is during a time when I think all of humanity was sort of wading through uncharted waters.
I feel like it's pretty crazy when you're in grade school, middle school, high school, and you have really no idea that once you, like, because you feel special, right? You're with your parents, yeah. You come home, like, hey, how was your day? It was great. Oh, it was the best part of your day. And they tell you, and you're like, oh, that's awesome. And then all of a sudden you're in the real world and nobody's asking you how your day was. Nobody gives a shit. They don't care. They don't give a shit at all. And they're just like, yep, sorry. Yeah, we got this other guy behind you. He looks a little bit better. Sorry, dude, you're out. And it's so hardcore. And there's no, I don't know, other than, I think if you probably grew up in a harder circumstance, you might be prepared for that. Like, I think there's people that grow up in abject poverty and have really, really hard upbringings that probably aren't so shocked. But like the average guy that's growing up in Western civilization has no idea how hardcore and cutthroat the real world really is.
Yeah. And I think that was the case for a lot of us. It was a huge wake up call, you know, and you got to remember when you're fresh faced out of college, you think you're the coolest thing in the world. You think you know everything. No one is smarter than you. You know, you're the hottest shit on the block.
Yeah.
And suddenly you get told no. A lot of people got told no for the first time in their life. And it's like, what? Why are you saying no to me?
I'm special.
Yeah, treat me like the special kid that my mom told me I was. But that's not the case. And we realized that. And so there we were, me and my friends sat on the open job market, degrees behind us, experience behind us, basically flipping patties. Just trying to do whatever we could. And I agree that there are people who are probably in much worse circumstances, certainly. But for us, it was a relatively hard time. And I look back at it now as a huge learning curve. But yeah, that was my short-lived stint or involvement with the Air Force was going through their entire application process, their entire candidate program, to then right at the end, when you're all hyped up and excited and ready to go, being told, forget it, you're done.
When I look at your CV, it says that you have the highest score for aptitude in Air Force history. Surely they could have found something else for you to do.
I thought that too. And people are going to listen to this and think, what? That's bullshit that you've just called that fact out. I will defend it. So yeah, the CBAT is basically it's an aptitude test that you have to pass to become a pilot. And it deals with a lot of mental arithmetic. The one of the tests they do is they have you doing like maths equations while in one ear they've got like a baby screaming and in the other ear they've got like rock music playing, and the whole time you've got to do this math sum, and then there's colors flashing up on screen, and then there's like someone fake shooting bullets. You've got to do all this and get all the questions right. It's those sort of questions that like handle mental agility under pressure.
I'm sitting here making a reel for Instagram on my phone and my kid's talking and I'm losing it. I'm like, shut up, I can't do it. I'm serious, man.
It's an interesting test. And it's one that they use to basically separate the wheat from the chaff. If you can pass that, you have a very strange kind of brain, but it's the kind of brain that they look at and think you can fly a jet. And I passed that test. To put it into perspective, it doesn't have anything to do with the kind of skill or experience you have. One of the guys that was sat in the test room with me was a commercial airline pilot and he failed. So it's got nothing, as far as I know, it's got nothing to do with your experience, your education. It is purely mental aptitude and agility, which is kind of ironic because every time I look at the people I work with and those around me, I think I am stupid. I work with some seriously smart guys, you know, they make me look so dumb. But I passed this test, and the following day, I still remember, it was on the 29th of April, 2021 that I passed. And the following day, I got a phone call from who was the then head of recruitment or head of recruiting or something in the Air Force. And they called to personally congratulate me and say, you know, look, you've got the highest score we've ever had. What, like, did you cheat? And then they started investigating into whether or not I was cheating. And they were reviewing CCTV of the exam room and everything. And I said, no, I promise. I was scared shitless. I was like, I've got these like really, really intense people investigating me, asking me if I cheated.
Yeah, and MI6 is involved at this point.
I was terrified. I was so scared. I was like, no, I promise you, I haven't cheated. I'm just weird. So yeah, that's something that I, at the end of the test, you get a little paper printout of your results. And to this day, it hangs next to my university degree because I sort of look at it as like my greatest mental achievement. And I've had friends who are in, you know, active serving members of the Air Force, pilots and other personnel, look at that certificate and they're like, what the, how did you do that?
That's what makes that contrast of not getting in probably hurt.
It's quite weird. It's there to me as a little reminder that there's some part of me that might be special. I have yet to find out what it is, but it's somewhere. So that's sort of it. It's like a weird niche statistic, but anyone who's involved in that world or that industry will look at it and they will know what it is.
So you're working at the grocery store. You're putting away cabbage or something, right? So you're working at the grocery store after being declared the smartest guy in Air Force history, or at least the most tolerant to stress, which is amazing. And now you're working at putting away lettuce while some lady is asking you where the glass bottles of ketchup are. What kind of jobs are you applying for? You just like, is it like carpet bombing, like any engineer job? Or did you go straight to like AlphaTauri and be like, hey, I want to work for you guys again. I had an internship. Like how do you move from the grocery store into the Formula One thing?
It was both. It was calling everyone, you know, it was cold calling people. It was getting sworn at and told to fuck off and everything when you're like literally getting in touch with everyone in the industry. Carpet bombing job applications left, right, and center. Literally every night I'd be at my computer just applying. And yeah, there was a lot of calling back my old boss at the F1 team and saying, look, you know, please, can I come work? Can I come work for you? And it was like, there was always a reason why I couldn't. It was, oh no, right now we're limited on numbers because of the pandemic and we can't, and everyone's working from home and we can't really find a job for you. And that went on for quite a while. And one day I got a call from someone I'd been studying with. His name was Alex, and Alex Babich, he's an amazingly talented engineer. And he could sell ice to an Eskimo, honestly. And he called me up and he said, hey, we're looking for a design engineer. We want someone who can just do basic drawings, who can work on cars, who can do this kind of stuff. You know, not very taxing, not very hard work, not very like mentally stressful or anything. We just want someone who can do the work here. And he was at a company called Electrogenic, who are still going to this day. Amazing firm, absolutely amazing company, great team of people. And he said, why don't you come over and come and have a chat with us, and we'll see if we can find something for you to do. And I said, yeah, okay. And went over, had a talk to them, and sort of then just immediately left the world of retail, which I'm so freaking thankful for. And went to work for them for a couple of months. And while I was there, I was then playing Call of Duty one night with some friends of mine. And two of those friends were at the Formula One team. And they said, hey, we had someone leave recently, so there's a vacancy. Why don't you give so-and-so a call? And I thought, okay. And I shot him a text. This is my now boss. I shot him a text message and I say, hey, I heard you've got an opening. Would you mind if I had a chat to you about that? And could I perhaps come back to the team? And it evolved, and a casual conversation then turned into an interview.
What's your skill set at that time? At that time, when you're working at this Electrogenic place and this guy, you're trying to get in with your boss that you have now, what is your skill set that you're able to offer the team? Like, what are you giving them?
I'd say at that point it was graduate who thinks he knows everything, who's slightly good at working on stuff with spanners. It was very weird because the job that I do now is totally different to what I was doing at Electrogenic. And so I had very little to offer in the way of the actual skills required for what I do now and what I do every day. But I could offer the basic skills that any engineering graduate would have straight out of college. So it was the ability to do drawings, to understand the maths, to understand design software, CAD, if people listening will know what that is.
Do you think he saw somebody that had a relatively high intelligence that he could kind of form to put in places that whatever he needed you to do versus having you just be like this hammer instead of a more diverse tool?
I think at first it was to fill, it was to get bodies in the shop. It was to fill a role, and slowly the role has evolved into what it is today, which is a more, I don't know how to explain it. You have to look at the function of a model maker or the people who work in wind tunnels and on wind tunnel models as something that's evolved over time with the sport. And when I joined them, when I came back, I was very much just a body who was like, okay, bolt this on, do this, get that done. And now the role has evolved into so much more than that, but so has the industry. So has the stuff that we work on. It's a constantly evolving thing. It's more complex. It's more diverse. There's more software involved. There's more electronics involved. There's slowly those kind of things and those skills began to build up. And I like to think that I've evolved with them and evolved in the role. It would be a shame if I hadn't actually, because it means I've learned nothing over the last 2.5 years. Yeah. So that's really where I am now. It's like I feel like I'm now at a point where I fit the role that they initially intended to me.
So what is it that you do generally? Like what's day at the shop like?
I'm a model maker. That sounds like really weird. Like, what the hell do you do? Model makers are the guys who physically put the wind tunnel model together. We bolt stuff on, modify stuff, we machine stuff, we do everything that involves the physical creating, building, running, maintenance of the model.
And this is like a scale model, right? It's like full size, like 50% or 75 or 60% size, right?
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Every Formula One team uses a 60% scale wind tunnel model. I've got to be very careful about what I talk about now because a lot of it's confidential. But
let's just talk in generalities about everything.
I'm going to speak in very, very general terms. So the wind tunnel model is, imagine the world's biggest RC car.
It sounds awesome.
It's a living, moving, it doesn't breathe, but it's a moving thing. And I would say there's as much technology packed into that model as there is in the full-size car.
Could I drive that car? Does it move?
Jake Solberg might fit, but not you.
Thanks for that. That's beautiful. I love that.
He's going to hate me for that.
Beautiful.
No, it's a 60% scale. So imagine you take every dimension, the length, the width, the height, you shrink them all. You put them in a machine, you shrink them.
Yeah.
And within that model are all of the systems required to make it behave like a full size car. So obviously in a wind tunnel it can't move, it can't go anywhere. But beneath it, it has a rolling road. Mm-hmm. A physical belt, which is like a very rough aggregate surface. So it feels like tarmac. And that moves with the model. So the model rolls on this road. And the model moves and steers and goes up and down and pitches and everything on this road as well to simulate exactly what the full-size car is doing on track.
So you guys have to simulate the downforce at given speeds and everything like that with like actual, I mean, you don't have to say yes. I don't know if it's all secret, but I'm just imagining to like simulate the downforce of the car. It's got to go up. It's got to go down. You've got to put load on the suspension. And I've seen this, like there's a video back in the day that came out of testing the E39 M5 and all the things that they did. And it's like the suspension is like spinning around and going up and down. They're compressing it and doing all these different things. I imagine you guys have to do all of that stuff to simulate every single conceivable possibility on every circuit that you guys are going to be racing on. You have to do everything. I bet you guys have a program that you don't say yes or no. I bet you guys have a program that is like, it's Monaco and you put the car on the conveyor belt and it probably even simulates the rumble strips. I mean, it's got to be so amazing what you guys are able to do to actuate these cars to test them.
So we don't simulate each circuit, but we can, but we don't. We can because that would be very tough. We can, but we don't because it would be an incredibly time consuming exercise. Sure. So what we have are what we call maps, and a standard map simulates the different types of corners that you'll get, and it simulates the different stages of each corner. So high speed corners, low speed corners, tight corners, fast corners. And throughout the map, the car moves according to what corner you're trying to simulate. So you said BMW's explanation with the M5 is the perfect example. The car and the model suspension will move to simulate exactly what it's doing on track. So the tires will be squashed and deformed, and the suspension will go up and down, and the model will go up and down, and if you were to look at a car on track and keep it in a camera frame, a perfect frame, and you had no other environmental factors and you couldn't see anything else around it, and then you overlaid that video with a video of the wind tunnel model, they'd look very similar. Their movements and their motions would look very, very similar.
Here it is. This is the...
This is exactly it. Yeah. That is, imagine exactly that happening, but not a full-size BMW M5.
So why is it like not full-size? What is the reasoning behind having it be 60% of a real... Why not just build the real car? You're 60% of the way there. The
biggest thing there is cost. 60% model means we can make smaller parts, we can make more parts, we can test more stuff more frequently. Building a full size model of every, or a full size wind tunnel component of every part you're going to use on the car, or every aero surface, would be an incredibly expensive exercise. There's a massive cost saving involved. There are teams that used to test full size cars, and there are some hilarious stories about testing full size stuff. And it, you know, that comes with its own pains and heartaches and benefits. But over the years, the consensus has led towards the teams standardizing on the 60% scale. So
I suppose when it's you're paying for 40% less carbon fiber and machining time, that does add up. And you guys, but your budget is pretty strict. Like all the stuff that's going to what you're doing, does that count towards the limit of what the team can spend? Right,
yeah,
all that stuff adds up, right?
It's all under the same budget cap. So that's been a huge talking point in the sport recently, and that budget cap extends to R&D. It extends to every facet of the team, and every department has to fall under that cap. So that's had a huge impact on the way that wind tunnel testing has evolved as well, because it used to be that if you had we had Team A, and they had a huge wind tunnel facility that they were able to invest millions and millions and millions into, they could test 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And then you have Team B, who's at the back of the grid, who has not many sponsors, who's, you know, very, very small and up and coming. They can only afford to rent a wind tunnel to test 1 day a week.
Right.
The introduction of the cost cap was primarily to reduce that gap and bring about closer competition through more regulated testing and other things as well. But one of the things that they have, the FIA have done to ensure that this is kept to is not only the size, but the time that you're allowed to spend in the tunnel. So if you're a follower of the sport, you'll know that in 2021, Red Bull exceeded their budget cap, their limit. They claim it was on €1 million worth of catering, but I work at the Red Bull facility and the vending machine is still shit. So I don't know where that million euros in catering went.
You didn't
went,
get any of it, right? No, there's no steak dinners.
It was none to us. Yeah, the vending machine breaks all the time. You have to shoulder barge it to get stuff to fall out.
What's the aerodynamic coefficient of a vending machine? You guys ever put shit in the aero tunnel?
I'd love to do it just for fun.
You ever just stand in there and just be like, how aerodynamic is a 6'5" dude? Like, test the coefficient?
Not very. My hair goes all over the place if I'm sitting there with the wind on. It's pretty – the bald guys are definitely better.
This is a pretty high-pressure environment. You know, you look at, like, the guy who cross-threads wheel nuts. I mean, that guy probably gets shit-canned pretty fast. You're working in a pretty high-pressure place. How do you deal with the pressure – and what makes it worth it?
I think you've got to look at the sort of culture of English engineers and British guys in general. And we deal with a lot of stuff through humor. You speak to American soldiers who have served with English soldiers, and they'll tell you that the Brits are the funniest guys in the world, but also that the Brits are the only ones who, when the chips are down and they're getting shot in the face and the shit's hitting the fan, they light the cigarette, take a swig of tea and say, come on, let's go. That tenacious attitude is definitely the foundation for the way that we work. And
Where does that come from?
You know,
where's that come from? That tenacity in British culture and history.
I think that not to reminisce on it, but I think a lot of it comes from the war. A lot of it comes from the two world wars that have impacted this country. It's a cultural thing. It's ingrained in us to not give up. And that certainly reflects itself in motorsport. There are guys I've worked with who absolutely baffle me, that, you know, they will work through the day and through the night to get a job done. And I know people from other parts of the world who can't hold a candle to it. It is a high pressure environment. But it's one that I think the Brits excel in because of that cultural tenacity, because of that nature, because of the sense of humor that we have as well. You know, everything is funny. When it's 4 o'clock in the morning and you've been working all night and you're lying on your back under the car working on something and nothing's going right, nothing's fitting together, nothing works, someone will still crack a joke. Always. It's a guarantee. Yeah,
you got to embrace the absurd, man. I mean, life is absurd.
You have to. And I think it's something the Brits do incredibly well. And it's something they're incredibly proud of. And no offense to you guys. It's that sense of humor that I think Americans don't really get. I used to work with an engineer from Texas who he's now at Corvette Racing. But he never understood like any of the jokes that were going on in the workshop. He would just be stood in a corner, like not thinking anything was funny. And the British guys would be like hosing themselves laughing. So I think it's a cultural thing.
Yeah, it's a cultural thing. I also think it's like it's a masculine thing too. And I don't know, like the guy that you worked with, but I think of the way in general that a lot of men treat each other is, and this might not be the type of humor you're talking about, but you have to be able to take being poked and prodded and made fun of and belittled and humiliated a little bit. You have to be able to take that, and you have to be able to dish it back, or you kind of get like shoved out. Like you kind of get discarded in higher pressure environments. I think you kind of get discarded because if you can't handle that, you can't handle any of this. So I think there's probably a self-selection process that the type of people you're working with are probably those types of people that can handle it.
That's exactly it. And if you can take being made fun of, and you can take the abuse, and you can take the jokes and the humiliation, you can deal with anything.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, that how we get through some of the toughest days in the tunnel, in the sport, in anything like that, is we make light of it. We see the funny side, we forgive each other, and we move on.
So I think you work in a world. I know that you work in a world of physics. Formula One works in a world of universal physics, right? And I think every year we kind of like we take this little section, we file it off, and it's a little bit better, right? The cars are a little bit faster every year, and it makes me think that I'm trying to get to a point of AI. Okay, so I'm trying to draw a line of getting to AI with these comments, just so you know where I'm at. And the human element of this is constant improvement, and we're able to get closer to that endpoint of the absolute best, but we'll never truly be able to get there because we're human, right? And I feel like AI is going to come along and it's going to ruin this. It's going to ruin this human element of, because it's going to know immediately. It's going to be able to compute, do math better than us. It's going to be you've looked at like the Zinger, for example, the company with all their 3D modeled printed suspension parts, something like that. we are going to accelerate, and the diminishing returns of what we're able to accomplish year to year in terms of Formula One, like they release a new formula, we're going to be able to plug it into a computer and it's going to do a lot of calculations on each team's going to have its own model. This is all hypothetical. Each team's going to have its own model for figuring out aerodynamics and engine dynamics and suspension dynamics. And this, I feel like we're going to lose this human element. So my question is AI going to ruin Formula One?
No. And I can say that confidently because there is a team who currently uses AI for generative modeling. And they use it for doing a lot of their CFD. I'm not going to name and shame them, but they're a team associated with a French manufacturer. They're based in Enstone, just outside Oxford. they've been using AI for a number of years to develop aerodynamic surfaces, to develop CFD, to sort of predict wind tunnel results, and it has not worked in their favor.
Why? Because do you think that
there is an innate, there is a human element to performance that you can never quantify, and that comes in any sport, be it motor racing, football, hockey, ice hockey, skiing, anything. Any sport is going to be governed by the human element, and that AI model that they are using might be looking at designing the car in the best way possible for the most elite human to use it. And it's trying to predict what that human is, but you can't do that. So I think as far as myself and the people I work with are concerned, our jobs are safe. AI is certainly, it's a scary prospect, but it's also something that we can use correctly if we're responsible with it. But I think it has a long way to go before it can overtake that human element, or it can replace that human element. That's my two cents on it. I think AI is interesting. Whether or not it has a place in the sport yet, I don't know. Certainly those that have tried to use it up until now have not been successful. That's sort of proven itself this year, especially. So that's got a long way to go. And at the end of the day, the most important piece of a Formula One car is the nut holding the steering wheel. That's it.
Yeah, for sure. So when you look at Formula One and the regulations that there are in the formula, what do you guys have to deal with in terms of aero? And I want to try and start shifting the conversation into how aero has developed over the years with regulation and increased, you know, size of the car and everything else. Cause that's, you know, I talked to a few of my friends, hey, I'm going to be interviewing this guy. What do you think? Every single person is like, why the F are the cars so big? What is going on? What is going on? Is it like an aero thing? What is it? So talk to me a little bit about the regulations of aero, how they've evolved in Formula One, and what you deal with in terms of current times.
I actually have something. It's not downstairs here. It might be upstairs. I have the rule book. I have a copy of the current rule book. It is the thickest damn thing you've ever seen in your life. The size thing is something I can address straight away. The cars nowadays have a lot more systems in them than they used to, and they're a lot safer. And I know that sounds a bit strange.
Look at this, though, dude. Look at this.
Oh, I love this. I love this graphic. I love this.
We're showing, listening, we're showing pictures of the cars based on their wheelbase. And if you look at the 50s, the cars have grown by over a meter. They're like, they are enormous. And it doesn't look like the width of the cars has changed very much, but they've gotten so, it's like someone just extruded everything and they're just so long.
Yeah. You've got to remember the current cars have an incredible amount of systems in there. The hybrid and battery package alone takes up so much space and so much volume and a lot of weight. It's an incredibly heavy package. And you've got to remember that without that, the cars would probably weigh about 150 kilos less. What's that in pounds? 300 pounds or so? I don't know.
Yeah, I was looking at the difference in the weights. I looked this up.
The difference in weights is scary.
It's 200 kilos. before and after. So it's like 200 kilos worth of batteries and other crap and weight that they've added. It's a lot of weight.
That's two of me. That's like driving around a car from 10 years ago with me strapped on each side of it.
Yeah.
That's a lot of weight. And I'm not necessarily a fat guy, but I'm big. The size is down to multiple factors. One, they've got more systems in them. Two, they are safer. So the crash structures are bigger. The impact structure on the store, the four impact structures on the side, the one at the front and the one at the rear, are substantially larger. And they have to be to take the added momentum that comes with the added weight of the added systems. So the size has come about as a result of adding all of these things and evolving the sport in a way which makes it safer.
Is it better?
My argument against that is a car from 20 years ago, were it to have a similar accident to today, which one would fare worse off? I've always maintained that the car from 20 years ago would fare better because it weighs about 250 kilos less and is therefore carrying less momentum. That's a physics calculation. That is a plain and simple physics calculation. The heavier car carries more momentum. And that is something that I've often queried and questioned when looking at the rules and looking at how the sport has evolved is I think, why are we not making the cars to be as intrinsically fast as possible, not just in a cornering and a high speed sense, but in an agility sense as well? And I think that's something that the cars have lost over the last, I'd say, 15 to 20 years, is that innate ability to be agile. There's incredible footage of, I think, Michael Schumacher qualifying at Imola in 2004. And the car is dancing. It's literally dancing. It's like it's ice skating. It's gorgeous to watch. And you look at that and it makes you, excited in a primal way. You think, this engine's screaming and sparks flying and it's amazing. It's wonderful. But the biggest visual difference is that the car is literally alive. And that's not something that we see these days. Sure, we see incredible qualifying laps and incredible race laps, but we don't see that element of on the edge-ness, if you will. We see the limits of grip and the physical limits of what a car can do, but I don't think they really speak to the limits of the sport and what people were able to do in much more, highly strung machinery, say 15, 20 years ago.
Well, you have to, then it boils down to what is the point of Formula One? Right.
Exactly.
Like, exactly. It's, you have to define that. Yeah. And if you define that, it makes sense where we are, right?
That I think is something that's been lost in translation as well, because Formula One should be the pinnacle of motorsport. It should be the best of the best of the best. It's the 20 or 30 best drivers in the world from across every series. They should be in Formula One. I would argue the best racing I can watch nowadays comes from IndyCar. Why is that? The cars in IndyCar are smaller, they're more unstable, they're more highly strung, and the racing is incredible. The talent
is
incredible.
Cars are far less advanced, right? So, I mean, you have to, like, the point of Formula One is supposed to have the most advanced technology, right? That's the way it always has felt that it is. It's always like, wow, yeah. Cosworth has a four-valve engine. Oh, my God, that's incredible. You look at all this stuff. That's always been the way. Is it getting in the way now?
I think it is. I think our rule book now is so strict and so stringent. And I'll go back to your question you had earlier about how the rule book defines aerodynamic limits and how we interpret that in the tunnel. But I do think that the rule book has somewhat got in its own way. Aerodynamic development in F1 is so restricted and so limited. Technological development in F1 is so limited and so restricted. Anytime someone comes out with something now, they're told they're not allowed to do it. And it's like, well, why not? If you're XYZ engineer at a team and you come up with a system that adds 100 horsepower, but it it's slightly expensive or it's slightly complicated, you suddenly are told you're not allowed to do it. I don't think that's fair. I personally don't agree with that. I think.
What's the mentality of the people that are saying that though? Like, what's the reason? There must be clamoring. You can't possibly be the only engineer and the only person in the Formula One world that wants things to be relaxed.
I'm not, I have got in trouble before for being outspoken. I definitely voice my opinions more than a lot of my colleagues, which is, I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. I know I'm not alone. There are other people in the sport. There are other people in my own workshop, in my own model shop that I work alongside who think about what F1 was like 10, 20 years ago. And we miss that. And we miss working on those, the kind of cars that came from that era. And a lot of them miss working on those cars. And ultimately, we are beholden to the rule makers and those who are more senior to us. And it's always like, people say, what would be your dream? You know, people say to a young engineer, oh, what would be your dream one day? And the response you normally get is that they want to be in charge of a team, or they want to be the chief mechanic or the chief engineer or the main designer. Honestly, I want to be the guy who writes the rule book, because this is my two cents, and I'm going to receive so much hate for this, but I don't care. I would give every team a budget. And I would say you have to make a car that costs this much, and it has to fit into these dimensions. It has to, you know, it can be no bigger than this and no wider than this. And it has to have a maximum engine capacity to this. There you go. Go mad. Go do whatever you can within those limitations. You have cost, you have an engine capacity or engine type, if you will. You have a limit on size, overall size, and then within those boundaries you say go nuts, build the fastest damn thing you can.
And well, now you're talking about painting the, you're just saying here's the Group B rule book, apply it to Formula One, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would be a fan of that.
I think you're right, but there's got to be a reason that they don't do it. You know, there's got to be a reason that things are
what
they are
a lot in the sport these days, and that is huge environmental factors, tree hugging hippies, and a lot of just, I don't know, it's a lot of red tape. It's a lot of bureaucratic red tape. It's a lot of,
can like, why can't we do
this?
Though. Oh,
because of this, because of this, because of this. It's
you can
so
still
sad.
Be fast, right? You can still be super fast and have an EV based or hybrid drivetrain.
Of course you can. But
so
why people don't want to do it, I don't know. Two main things I would change about the sport. I'd make the cars smaller and I'd make them lighter. That is it. I'd make them smaller and lighter. People constantly talk about better racing. You know, we want better racing, we want closer composition. Netflix, the assholes, always talk about better racing in their freaking series. And you have to look at the fundamental dynamics behind what makes better racing. And that is more agile cars, cars that can easily overtake each other, not through assists or other aids like DRS and kinetic energy and all that stuff, but through just simple hard and fast racing. And IndyCar has been a huge promoter of that recently, I think it's shown a lot of people in Formula One what can be achieved when you strip back the rule book, you make it less restrictive, you make the cars less restrictive, you make them smaller, you make them more agile, you make them feel like they could be out of control. And I don't mean that in a dangerous sense. I just mean they are so in control. They have so much grip and so much ability.
This is not correct. But from my perspective, I look at some, and this argument, it gets a little tired, but you look at some of the older cars and I go, there's no way I could do that. I would die immediately. But I feel like I could get in a brand new Formula One car, maybe if the traction control was turned on. You know, just the throttle modulation, it seems like it would be the hardest thing for me. But I feel like I could drive one. I feel like if someone gave me a shot, I could, I wouldn't die immediately. Maybe like third or fourth lap, I would die. But like, I feel like these old cars, it's just instant death, instant out of control.
There are some cars I look at. We're lucky enough to have events in the UK where we showcase a lot of them. You know, funny enough, about 20 miles up the road from me right now at Donington Park, the historic F1 Masters series are doing their test day. And those are cars from the 70s and 80s. And I know a few guys who were there today, and they wanted to know if I could come with and join them, but I couldn't. I had other stuff on this morning. They are running cars that I look at and I think, absolutely no fucking way. I'm not getting in that. And I've never shied away from driving a car if anyone's ever given me the keys. But there are some F1 cars I look at from that period and I think, absolutely not.
You mentioned Netflix. And I wanted to ask how you feel, because here, let me preface this and say, you're never going to get the changes you want in Formula One until they see a reason to change things. They're going to see like a drop in attendance, a drop in revenue, a drop in viewership, whatever. And the Netflix thing has certainly made sure that is not happening.
Yeah.
So tell me how you feel about media and Formula One.
I don't like it. Netflix's series, the Drive to Survive series, is incredibly fabricated. It's incredibly fake, and a lot of drivers over the last, other personnel over the last season or two have boycotted it as a result. Even the commentary is fake. The commentary that Netflix use, I've seen a clip of the guy in the recording studio doing the commentary with lines in front of it. I don't like that. I agree that it's increased the popularity of the sport. But you have to remember that Formula One was never unpopular. So people say, oh, it's increased the popularity so much and that pays for tickets, which pays your salary. And I think, well, yeah, but if it didn't, I'd still go and work on race cars somewhere else. You know, it's not changed my interest in it. It's certainly not changed the interest of people around me. The guys who I work with, the guys who I studied with, we've always loved racing. And I think there's an element of the way that we behave, which is slightly gatekeepish, which I'm not proud of. But whenever someone says they got into Formula One because of Netflix, my first instinct is to tell them to piss off.
I mean, if you can give anyone an entry into it that would never have watched it otherwise. My thought is, though, that person that's into Formula One because of the show is probably not watching the actual races. They just watch the show.
That's what I mean. If it's because of the show, great. If that was their introduction and now they have made the effort to learn about the sport and get involved, and that's different. But if they are purely a fan of the show and they've never actually watched a race, or they've never bothered to learn anything about any of the teams or the drivers or people from the past, I don't want to speak to them. That's my two cents on it. I think Netflix has done incredible things for the popularity of the sport in the US, which was dwindling.
Right. I mean, I don't think you'd have Las Vegas without Drive to Survive.
Oh, certainly not. No, certainly not. And that is a direct result of the increased popularity in the States through Netflix. But to say that it was... there are people who say that Formula One was brought back from the dead by Netflix. Well, I think, no, it wasn't. It was never unpopular.
Well, yeah, it's just you have to look at it. You only think that way in terms of people get really, really focused on Western civilization. I think if you look at like Asia and like the Middle East and like Australia and stuff like that, Formula One was never unpopular. It never dipped. It was never unpopular. That's kind of like a Western thing, but we have an attention problem anyway.
Yeah, it was never unpopular in the UK, in Europe as well. Everyone knows everyone. Oh, everyone here knows someone who works in F1 or who works in motor racing or who works in motorsport. It's again, a cultural thing. You've got to remember, this is where Formula One came from. You know, I live 25 minutes from the circuit that hosted the first ever F1 race. It's something that was never going to die, but perhaps could have done with a little bit of a boost at some point, but not, it was never on the brink of death. The Netflix thing is a funny one. I know people who have refused to watch it. I haven't really seen the last two or three seasons. Someone said this season has a jump scare where Danica Patrick appears on screen, and that just made me want to not watch it either. But
I don't understand. Yeah, I don't understand how she weaseled her way in the driver.
Yeah, like, no offense to Danica personally, but she was never a great personality in IndyCar or NASCAR, and for her to then have brought that attitude over to F1 is, I think, the wrong approach to the way that she's going about that job.
Yeah. All right. But one more question for you before I let you go.
No, I've got time.
Let me ask you this question. Then I want to ask you about, I want to actually touch on Electrogenic then, if you have time a little bit, and maybe some of that type of chat. What year of Formula One, of all the years, if you could go back and do what you do now, or do whatever you want to do, what year would it be and why? Where would you place yourself?
This is both passion and technological talk. I'm an enormous Michael Schumacher fan. Always have been, always will be. I mean, my earliest memories of Formula One was him and Mika Häkkinen and Kimi Räikkönen. And that era of F1 just, it was different gravy. It was something else. And that, I'd say between 2000 or like the late 90s to the end of the 2000s, experienced a huge leap in technological advancement, not necessarily speed, but as someone involved in engineering, I'd say that's where we saw a huge increase in technological advancement and the real science behind F1 cars. The construction and the physical geometries and the way that they were made didn't really change that much, but it was tiny things. It was like little introductions of electronic this here and some tiny little aero tweak here and this, that, and the other. And that period brought about one of the closest eras of competition I think we've ever seen.
But what about DRS? There was how did they do that without DRS? I don't understand.
No, that DRS is it's something I don't necessarily think is needed. If you built cars that behaved like race cars, you wouldn't need it.
That's my two cents.
But no, it goes back to one of your earlier questions about the limitations of the rule book and how we interpret things and how we sort of find those fine margins and look at the points of diminishing returns and then decide how far is too far and stuff like that. The way that the rule book was interpreted during that time period was incredibly clever. People were finding tiny gains, you know, tiny caveats. They'd read the rule book once and then they'd read it again and again and again to find out what it said you could do, but then to find out what it said you couldn't do. And the interpretation of
it sounds like I need that. That'd be great for marriage. I think I need a rule book so I can find out, like, I got to get some loopholes, I think.
F1 is what have been the ultimate sport for loopholes. And it's part of the reason that everyone in the company has access to the rule book. And it's the reason I've got a copy of it, and anyone else I work with is allowed a copy of it. If they want it, they can just get one. Because if you have an idea, you read a loophole somewhere, you go straight to your boss with that. You say, hey, check what I found. We can try this. We can do this.
Yeah, yeah. Is it like a Bible? Is it like hardcover with gold leaf
It's printed on like the cheapest copy paper, and it's like it's just like thrown around. I don't know if other people have something different.
Yeah, you'd think it would be like all super special and like, oh, you open up and like little beams of light come shooting out of it or something.
Oh, I wish. No, it's just a lot of maths. The rule book itself is there. It's funny because I'll touch back on something else you said, which was how do we look at the rule book and then how does that influence the aero regulations?
Yeah.
Formula One as a whole is currently, I don't think, and I might have colleagues listening who disagree with this, but I don't think it's the epicenter of technological advancement anymore because the rule book is so constrained and so tight. There's very little space to find something new. And when the guys in our aero department are modeling modeling surfaces and everything else, they talk in terms of legality, and they talk in terms of regions of legality and what is legal and what isn't. And someone could come up with an idea, but if it doesn't fit every single criteria to make it legal, you can't do it. And the legalities are things like this surface must not have a radius tighter than this number if it's next to another piece that has a radius tighter than this number. And they
who's
can't
coming
be...
up with this shit? Who is
honestly,
doing it?
I think someone directly translated a Chinese manual for a lawnmower and just that was it. It's so bad. Some of the rules are really strict.
You've seen what they've done with unregulated LMP1 cars.
Like,
was it Audi or Volkswagen, I think? They took one out and just like absolutely uncorked it and could see what it could really do. And why can't we just do the race cars? Why can't we just have the race cars be that way too?
That was the team of guys at Porsche. And I found out later, it was back in 2017. I remember the car you're talking about. I found out later that it was a team of like five dudes who did that, who headed up that thing. And I want to know what kind of Colombian export they took when they first decided to let rip on that car, because they did some awesome stuff. And it wasn't too different to the standard race car. It was slightly more powerful and had a slightly different motor and this, that, and the other. But it was very, very, very closely related to the actual car that they used. And again, it provoked that conversation of, well, why can't we all do this? Why can't we all make the fastest car possible? It's strange, but the way that aero regulations are governed now is incredibly strict. And there are, you know, teams of people looking over every single surface that's designed or created before it's sent to a wind tunnel, before it even touches my workbench. There are loads of guys who look at it in computer simulations, in legality simulations, and everything else, trying to see, is this legal? Can we do it? Does it work? Whatever. Okay. If it doesn't, start from scratch. And the unfortunate thing is that could waste a week of someone's time doing that. But that's the nature of the sport, unfortunately. It's finding those fine margins toward the point of diminishing returns. And that is why...
It's really a lost opportunity, right? Like we have, if you look at 70s, 80s, 90s, we went from carburation to turbocharging direct injection. Right. These are the technologies that advanced. We had huge leaps in technology. And once you got into the early 2000s, things kind of started to like, you know, even as a guy that just likes to tune his regular car, there's like less and less you could do. Right. If you were back in the day and you had carburetors, well, I'm going to swap to fuel injection. This is insane. Right. It was super insane. And I could see where it was like, OK, well, there's not that much more we can do. We can maybe pursue more aero. But really, the combustion engine is kind of. We can do direct injection and turbocharge it, increase compression. But like the evolution of the combustion engine kind of was reaching its logical peak where the diminishing returns were getting very, very small. And there was less, in my opinion, there was less and less you could do. And then came EV and hybrid technology and electric stuff, which whether you like it or not, is like a huge opportunity to create. And do something new and fresh and high performance and bend the rules and see everything that you can get out of something again for the first time, right? For the first time, we can see how far can we push this technology like they used to do with the gasoline engine. You can't do that anymore because we've already pushed it so damn far. There's really not that much left, but they won't let them do it.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And the other thing is you have so many people working on something and you have so many people... The industry is now oversaturated with ideas to the point that it's very rare that someone comes out with something brand new. Whereas the first guy who strapped fuel injection onto something, you know, that wasn't very popular or there weren't many people working on stuff. So everyone looked at him and was like, oh my God. But nowadays you have teams and teams of people and it's designed by committee. So there's no one person standing out with an idea saying, hey, let's try this or let's do this, that, and the other. And I think there's a lot to be said for giving someone a blank check and just telling them to go off into a room somewhere.
People, it's like the media is rough now. Social media is rough. You fuck up, you get slapped. Nobody wants to get slapped.
Yeah.
There's shareholders that you have to be responsible for. And I mean, there were shareholders back in the day too, but most of the time the shareholders were just going about their lives and maybe looking at the newspaper at the end of the night while their wife made them dinner. Now it's in your face all the time. You can see all the bad things that happen or don't happen. The mistakes people made are so raw and apparent to everyone that it's really tough to put yourself out there. It's really tough to take risks.
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes from the fact that a lot of people my age or coming into the industry now don't want to make mistakes. And if I could, I'm still very young. I don't think I'm in any way qualified to give advice to anyone. But if I were to give anyone younger than me advice, I would say don't be scared to fail. Don't be scared to go out on a limb and fuck up. Don't be scared to get slapped for something. And the only way I've learned seriously hard lessons in professionally and personally is through failure. And professionally, I have failed. I'm not going to talk specifics, but I have made some costly mistakes in Formula One. And I've done things that I look back at and I think, how are you so stupid? And you don't learn unless you fail. And you have to be okay with failing. You have to be okay with being called out for stuff. And I think a lot of people are too scared to be called out for something. That's, you've got to learn to take, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, which is taking the abuse. If you screw up, you've got to be able to own it and say, you know, yeah, okay, I screwed up, but how do we improve? How do I learn from it? That's a huge part of dealing with the environment that we're in as well, is being able to take the abuse, being able to take that you've made a mistake and being able to get on with it.
Yeah, and I think owning it is important. You know, I talk to my kids all the time when they screw something up. I'm like, hey, just own it. What'd you do? Just own it. Just take just own it. It's yours, you know?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We've all made mistakes. I've certainly made a few professionally. I could talk about this because it's absolutely moronic and it's just stupid. I left last week. We were in the wind tunnel. I was working on the car. It wasn't even that late at night. Like, I wasn't tired or anything. I was just being brainless. And I left a pair of scissors inside the engine cover of the car, bolted it all up, and they sent it in the wind tunnel. At any point, could those scissors have flown out? And that would have been one of the most expensive fuck-ups of my life, because, yeah, you don't want to send a pair of scissors down a multi-million-dollar facility.
No, I wouldn't think so.
And I, to this, like, today, I got a message from a colleague about it, still making fun of me for it. But I own it. Yeah. And I, at the time, I said, look, guys, I'm really sorry. I absolutely screwed up. I don't know what I was thinking.
That kind of behavior just isn't going to cut it.
No, exactly. Yeah. I had a really difficult day after that, because I heard it from everyone, and news had spread around to every other team as well that I'd done that. And I was getting messages from friends at like Aston Martin and at Ferrari. And it's like, what did you do in the tunnel? I was like, yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah.
I realized that, you know, okay, I did screw up. And it's a minor thing. That's not like the biggest mistake that people have made, but it's still those kind of things you learn from. You say, okay, I'm going to maybe work differently so that I don't do something like that again. But mistakes happen. You just have
it
to
also breeds trust again amongst your peers too. If you're able to own it, it breeds trust.
Yeah,
you know, nobody doubts you. Well, I mean, they may doubt your ability to do something, but they're not going to doubt your integrity. Which I think
I doubt my own ability every day. I think, how the hell do they let me loose in this facility? when I think about the guys I work with, and I think about how some of them are so much more experienced and so much older than me, I think, how the hell have they let me, like who's left me in this place on my own? Like, who decided that was a good idea?
Who gave this man a pair of scissors?
Yeah. Who gave me tools? Oh, no. I could do a lot of damage if I wanted to, but I'm not going to.
Andy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, man. I really appreciate it. I've been looking for this. Okay. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I'm glad we waited until you left the scissors in the engine compartment to have you on the podcast.
So we could talk about that.
I think we should have you on again sometime. I really appreciate it. Take care of yourself, and good luck.
Thank you, man. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay.
All the best.